He always has a sidekick, some boy wonder at his call. His utility belt holds everything, can't find that at the mall. The Batmobile is super fast, there is no car that is surpassed. It's a good thing we've got Arkham, cause he really drives us bats.
Drives us fast, drives us fast, he really drives us fast, 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 he drives us fast.
Dancing the bat.
Welcome to the podcast that's listened to by Martha's Everywhere. It's Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith. Joining me, as always, is a man who spent millions of dollars trying to digitally remove his own mustache.
Mike Sicuccio.
How are you doing today, Mike?
Good. I was not expecting either of those, and both of them were perfect.
Thank you. I was very
well
proud
done.
Of those. I thought of them in about 3 seconds right before we started this, so I'm proud of those. If you've never listened to Film Bookcast before, first we start with some film news, and then we move on into some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever piece of media we've been consuming lately, and then after that, we move on into our featured review. This week, we are discussing the new film from director Zack Snyder and the fifth overall film in the DC Extended Universe, Justice League. Are you ready to dig into Justice League, Mike?
I am. I'm very excited to give just a brief overview of whatever. Just like, who cares?
Just a cursory glance.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like we've doled out a lot of really long episodes lately, so we're going to just spare everybody.
All right, we're going to try to anyway. I feel like as soon as we start talking about Justice League, we're going to be like, oh yeah, I didn't care for this.
And this one more thing.
Oh, but one more thing. Yeah, in doing so, we will be among the only people who are talking about Justice League that much, because this movie did not make a ton of money at the box office this past weekend, or as it when it first
what
came out.
What a shame, I guess.
But I want to say, this movie, its opening weekend made $96 million, which sounds like it's a pretty good chunk of money. But yeah. For a movie like Justice League, like for context, the original Iron Man made about $96 million on its opening weekend. And this is, 10 years later at the height of the superhero boom. It's got Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman and The Flash. Like, some of the biggest heroes of all time are in this movie. And it can't crack $100 million on its opening weekend at the box office. Thor Ragnarok made $150 million. A third Thor movie.
Yeah, this dumb Thor thing.
So, there's a lot of apathy towards Justice League right now, I think. And I'm interested in talking about it because I think it is such a weird movie in and of itself and a weird product. But we got to get into some film news first, Mike.
Hi, it's time for...
What?
It's time for...
Who?
It's time for...
Film news.
Hi, it's time for...
What?
It's time for...
Who?
It's time for...
Film news.
It's time for film news on Film Bookcast. Now, Mike, we don't have a ton of film news today because it has been the Thanksgiving holiday weekend, so usually things start to wind down for at least a little while. So I just have a few things that I wanted to briefly bring up. The first of which is that Murder on the Orient Express is actually doing pretty well at the box office, Mike. It's kind of become like a sleeper hit in certain circles, and I think that's kind of cool. Because it is offering something different than the usual, four quadrant PG-13 blockbuster. I mean, Murder on the Orient Express is also that, but I feel like it's more differently minded in certain ways. It's more aimed at adults than it is, the teenage mindset that superhero movies tend to be based on.
You come from Baghdad?
It's true. No detail escapes his notice.
Your ticket? I might also ask you if you enjoyed your time there as a governess. The chalk on your sleeve and the geography primer, a governess or a cartographer. I made my gamble.
I always begin them with geography and monster them till they have the world down cold. They may get lost in life, but I'll be damned if they don't know where they are.
And anyway, Kenneth Branagh, director of the original Murder on the Orient Express, not the original, but the current one, director of that film and also the star as Hercule Poirot, is now working on a sequel, which was hinted at the end of Orient Express, Death on the Nile, which I have not read, so I cannot give you any clues as to what that book is about. But it's kind of neat. The Hercule Poirot cinematic universe has officially begun.
Yeah, I have it on a hunch. It's about a murder on the Nile.
Ooh.
But we'll find out, I guess, together.
A murder? On the Orient Express?
Nope, nope, not this time. Not this time. Nope.
No, no. They don't.
It's slightly different.
The Orient Express doesn't travel to the Nile in this.
It's not also a boat. But yeah, I mean, this is cool. Why not? Like, we talked about it, I think, in the last episode, right? That yeah. I think we both kind of had fun with Murder on the Orient Express, especially Mustache as a character and all that silliness and stuff. So sure, why not? I'll have more Mustache murders solving hijinks. Yeah, I guess
that's. I think that's the exact phrase you want going into this movie: Mustache murder solving hijinks.
Yes,
you can put that on the poster, I think, and it'll sell a lot of tickets. Yeah, mm-hmm.
You're welcome. That one's for free, Mr. Bronner.
Yeah, I'm pretty into this idea. I think this is a potential franchise in the making for Kenneth Branagh. And it's just like a fun – I think it's going to be fun to watch him play this character if this indeed becomes a several movie franchise. Because he's in like – this character is the star of like 33 different books.
Yeah.
So conceivably, there could be a shitload of movies.
Yeah. I think – and if they can manage to wrangle up the same kind of caliber, huge ensemble casts that they had for Orient Express, like that, I think it'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah, because I think that is a lot of the appeal of Orient Express, is seeing these like kind of huge names in this period setting and this like, you know, fun murder mystery. So Death in the Nile can recapture that and maybe even do it better, then that could be pretty cool.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, I wanted to bring that up. And then otherwise, I just have some Marvel casting news, as always. We got to talk about some Marvel stuff. This podcast would be incomplete without it, Mike. You know, we're doing a DC movie today, so it's only fair to lighten to balance the scales a little bit, I guess, is what I'm saying. So we got a couple of casting news things that we wanted to get to. First is for the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And this is kind of a big one. Jude Law is joining the MCU as Mar-Vell, who... for the 99.9% of you who don't know who that is, Mar-Vell is the original Captain Marvel. He is going to be in the new Captain Marvel movie as sort of a mentor for Brie Larson's character, who is officially Captain Marvel in that movie.
Okay, interesting. All right,
you following me so far?
I'm with you so far. So kind of a Hank Pym to Scott Lang kind of relationship type thing.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely kind of what it is. And yeah, I mean, and Carol Danvers, Brie Larson's character, has kind of become the more iconic character in recent years. But Mar-Vell has a lot of history in the Marvel universe. If you want to get really confused, DC also has a character in Captain Marvel, and that character
is it like a slam on Captain Marvel?
they just kind of both had the characters named Captain Marvel for a long time, and then to avoid confusion, DC changed that character's name to Shazam.
Wow, yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, so Shazam was originally named Captain Marvel, but Mar-Vell is not Shazam. He is just the original Captain Marvel, who will be mentoring the current Captain Marvel.
So 1 + 1 + 2 + 1.
+2 + 1 +, yes.
Got it.
Anyway, so I think it's cool Jude Law joining the MCU, another big get, another big name for them.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of neat. And also, James Franco is joining the X-Men universe as Multiple Man for his own solo movie.
Uh-huh.
Do you know who Multiple Man is, Mike?
I don't, but I'm gonna guess he can make clones of himself.
Bingo! Yeah, I got it. It's
more, crushed it.
It's less clones and more like illusions of himself, kind of like, you know, he can create different versions of himself that can, like, you know, help out and do things, but they disappear and stuff like that. And apparently, like, I haven't read a ton of Multiple Man comics, so I don't know that much about the character.
I feel like nobody has, probably.
Well, there were actually a lot of people who were like, actually, Multiple Man, if you're going to make an X-Men a solo movie, Multiple Man might be one to do. Like, he's somebody who actually has a decent amount of a backstory and has an interesting power set. What's crazier to me is that James Franco is going to be starring in his own solo superhero movie. That's like... It doesn't matter what the character is. I just think that's nuts that James Franco is playing a superhero. You know what I mean?
He just loved playing more than one character on the Deuce so much that he had to do a movie where that was his whole shtick.
Did you watch the Deuce at all by any chance?
No. Okay. No, I haven't.
The Deuce was great. I think I talked about it on the podcast a little while ago, but the Deuce was great. And James Franco playing two characters was a highlight of that show for sure. So I am very much eager for James Franco's Multiple Man movie. I think that's it's a cool thing, and I think this show is the X-Men. Fox is kind of allowing the X-Men universe to kind of just breathe and like just greenlight a whole bunch of shit and see what sticks. I think, and if they get a cool director on this, like, that's great. I'm on board. Because right now, I mean, they've got Deadpool 2 coming out. They've got New Mutants. Gambit is in production right now with Gore Verbinski. And they've got Dark Phoenix happening. And, you know, so this could conceivably fit into that mold of, like, you know, Logan was huge and Deadpool was huge. Like, they're letting their filmmakers right. take risks with their universe. I think it's paying off for them. So I'm eager to see what James Franco can bring to the multiple man role.
Yeah, I think we're going to enter into a postmodern superhero. I mean, we're already there, but like a postmodern superhero era of films, like, you know, where we get the Deadpool and Logan, just a lot more in that kind of just, yeah, sure, do whatever you want kind of superhero movie.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So, like, I guess that we'll get a multiple man, and then it'll cross over with Black Cat and Silver Sable, and it'll be wild. It's the untamed landscape or whatever. I had a phrase there, but it worked all day, and I lost it.
By bringing up Black Cat and Silver Sable, are you implying this movie is never going to happen? Is that what you think?
No, I think it's going to be a sleeper hit nobody's expecting.
All right. You're playing both sides of the coin there, Mike. I like it.
So, yes.
Anyway, that about does it for film news today. Like I said, not too much going on. It is a holiday weekend. So let's move right on into our discussion.
Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're going to talk about movies for our discussions.
All right, it's time for our discussions here on Film Bookcast. Mike, what do you have to discuss with us today?
So keeping with the theme of just kind of light and easy this week, I've only watched one movie between the last episode, and that was Taika Waititi's debut. Well, not his debut, right? I don't think so.
He's made a couple movies before this.
Okay, his American breakout, I guess we'll say. What We Do in the Shadows.
Are you a virgin?
Yes.
No.
You were a virgin when we were seeing each other?
Yeah, I was 12.
You said he was a virgin.
I think we drink virgin blood because it sounds cool.
I think of it like this. If you were going to eat a sandwich, you would just enjoy it more if you knew no one had f***ed it.
It's a mockumentary-style documentary that follows a group of vampires struggling to live with a modern life, to cope with modern life in New Zealand, basically. And it's just the silliest, wackiest thing. Taika Waititi, Jermaine Clement, I think, from Flight of the Conchords, star in it. And there's another guy who I don't remember his name. The not famous one, at least in America.
Yep.
And they just play these vampire roommates, and it's just, like, absolutely hilarious. And it's played with the most serious deadpan. Waititi is so effectively able to use, like, the documentary form and format to make this, like, a serious kind of I forgot their name. Maisel's Brothers, I think, that made
Melee's Brothers. Yeah, they had Gimme Shelter and stuff like that.
Yeah, just this kind of, like, fly on the wall style documentary where, like, the documentarians live in the house with the family and all this stuff. But it's just vampires. that's like the whole shtick.
Yep.
And just that you know, making it, these characters are so deadly serious about the stuff they're doing, but it's just it's just all silly. And it's a lot of fun. It's a good, like, hour and a half of vampire romp. And basically everyone else that watched this movie was right that it was good. So also watch it, I guess.
Yeah, I've been a big fan of What We Do in the Shadows for a while, and I think that's the first Taika Waititi movie I ever watched. That's the one that got me on the Waititi train. And I guess Taika train would actually probably be a better name of it.
Or Waititi wagon.
Boom, there it is. The Waititi wagon. What We Do in the Shadows is great. It's super funny. I used to quote that all the time when I first saw it. There's, you know, there's just, like, lines of dialogue that make me laugh a lot. It's just like, we're werewolves, not swearwolves, something like that.
We're werewolves, not swearwolves.
They're like chanting that to each other. Look, it's great stuff. So if you haven't seen What We Do in the Shadows, it is streaming right now on Amazon Prime. So it's definitely worth checking out if you haven't seen it yet. We talked about it a little bit last week, too, when we were talking about Thor Ragnarok. And so definitely go see Thor Ragnarok if you haven't seen that yet, because it is pretty awesome. Just throwing that out there. Support Taika Waititi however you can, because he's the best.
Correct.
And I got a few discussions today, Mike. I got six movies to talk about. Not to dwarf your accomplishments. Or anything like that.
I managed to set aside an hour and a half of my time in the last 2 weeks. All right.
Right. To be fair, I got that movie pass, so I'm, you know, just seeing movies like crazy these days.
You're Mr. Movies.
Yes. That's what they call me. That's what that's what's on my business card is Mr. Movies. Mm-hmm. He sees the movies with his movie pass. anyway, have a few movies I want to talk about today. The first one is T2 Trainspotting, directed by Danny Boyle, and stars Ewan McGregor, Ewan Bremner, Johnny Lee Miller, and Robert Carlyle. This is the sequel to 1996's Trainspotting, which I hadn't seen in a really, really long time. Probably like maybe freshman year of college was the last time I watched it. But I always really liked it back then. I always liked that movie a lot. Have you seen, you've seen the original Trainspotting, right, Mike?
Yes, but it's one of those things I've only seen once, and it was a while ago, like during college sometime. I can't remember exactly when.
Yeah, yeah. I had put off watching T2 for a little while because I wanted to rewatch the original before I saw it. But, you know, I was getting towards the end of the year, and I didn't have time. So I just went in with T2 Trainspotting, and I think it might have made the experience even better. Because it is, the movie is so much about the examination of like the passage of time. And so it's kind of constantly calling back to the original in sometimes subtle, sometimes unsubtle ways. But it's kind of relying on your memory of it. And so I think having like almost a hazier memory of the original kind of enhances this one, in a certain respect, because this is 20 years later. And you kind of see the journey these characters have taken over these last 20 years and what leads them back into each other's lives. And it's pretty great. And Ewan McGregor is giving a fantastic performance. He has this whole monologue calling back to the Choose Life monologue from the original movie.
Choose Life was a well-meaning slogan from a 1980s anti-drug campaign. And we used to add things to it. So I might say, for example, choose designer lingerie. In the vain hope of kicking some life back into a dead relationship. Choose handbags. Choose high-heeled shoes, cashmere and silk, to make yourself feel what passes for happy. Choose an iPhone made in China by a woman who jumped out of a window and stick it in the pocket of your jacket fresh from a South Asian fire trap. Choose Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, Instagram, and 1,000 other ways to spew your bile across people you've never met. Choose updating your profile. Tell the world what you had for breakfast and hope that someone somewhere cares. Choose looking up old flames, desperate to believe that you don't look as bad as they do. Choose live blogging from your first wank to your last breath, human interaction reduced to nothing more than data. Choose 10 things you never knew about celebrities who'd had surgery. Choose screaming about abortion. Choose rape jokes, slut-shaming, revenge porn, and an endless tide of depressing misogyny. Choose 9/11 never happened. And if it did, it was the Jews. Choose a zero-hour contract and a two-hour journey to work. And choose the same for your kids, only worse. And maybe tell yourself it's better that they never happened. And then sit back and smother the pain with an unknown dose of an unknown drug made in somebody's fucking kitchen. Choose unfulfilled promise and wishing you'd done it all differently. Choose never learning from your own mistakes. Choose watching history repeat itself. Choose the slow reconciliation towards what you can get rather than what you always hoped for. Settle for less and keep a brave face on it. Choose disappointment and choose losing the ones you loved. And as they fall from view, a piece of you dies with them. Until you can see that one day in the future, piece by piece, they will all be gone, and there'll be nothing left of you to call alive or dead. Choose your future, Veronica. Choose life.
So much really fun and interesting stuff, but also like really kind of like weirdly depressing stuff. It's you know, exactly like the original Trainspotting, but a little more melancholy in some respect. And the original Trainspotting has some dark stuff in it.
Yeah, more melancholy. Interesting.
But this is more, I guess I'm trying to say it's like more of a quiet film, like more of an introspective movie than the original Trainspotting. While at the same time having all that same like energy that the original movie had. There's a lot of like really fun sequences, you know, Ewan McGregor and Ewan Bremner getting into some like crazy shit and all that. So well worth checking out if you're a fan of the original, if you're a fan of Danny Boyle, or just if you're interested in seeing these actors, how they've grown over the past 20 years, because it's pretty cool. And I also wanted to talk about Battle of the Sexes, which is the new movie directed by Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris, who are the directors of Little Miss Sunshine. And this stars Emma Stone as Billie Jean King and Steve Carell as Bobby Riggs. And it is just it's based on a true story of the Battle of the Sexes between those two in the tennis world. And it's a pretty enjoyable underdog sports movie. It works. It's a sexism is bad message movie kind of
all right, thing. Yeah. Could use some of that right now,
Exactly. It definitely feels like a movie that was written before the 2016 election took place. And so the foregone conclusion was that Hillary Clinton was going to win. And so it seemed like this was going to like this like reinforces that almost.
Yeah.
And so that's a little weird. It was kind of nice to just watch anyway. Anyways, and Emma Stone is great in this role. She's actually she's really good as Billie Jean King. I think my problem with it is that the movie is probably like 60% Billie Jean King and 40% Bobby Riggs. And I think if you could just cut out Bobby Riggs' story entirely, this movie would, this movie would be a lot better. And it's pretty good as is. And I think you know, the final match, the actual battle of the sexes, it's, you know, they use a lot of the original commentary from the match, and they use a lot of the a lot of footage that's made to look like. Like, it's made to look like it's an actual tennis match, so it's just, like, the overhead shot of, you know, like, how you would watch it on TV. And it's kind of cool. So, very, very enjoyable kind of underdog sports story. Nothing, like, super special, but I think a lot of fun, nonetheless. Also wanted to give a shout-out to Wheelman, which is a new Netflix original directed by Jeremy Rush. Now, Mike, you haven't heard of Wheelman, right?
I have not, no.
Okay, this is a really lean, like, quick car chase movie. Starring Frank Grillo, and it gets in, gets out, does it very effectively, and it's, you know, it's an hour and 20 minutes long, so it just kind of does its thing and gets out. It's very committed to its gimmick, which is that the entire movie takes place from the perspective of the car. So what I mean by that is the camera is always in or around the car. You basically never leave the car for the entirety of the movie. And even when the action isn't explicitly inside the car, the camera still stays there. So there's a scene in the movie where Frank Grillo stops the car and gets out and goes into a building, but the camera stays in the car, and you're just watching him walk into the building and then eventually like walk out and like beating some dude up, and then coming back into the car. There's one scene like maybe midway through. That ditches the car, but that's only so it can get into another car. And
that's pretty awesome.
Yeah. So I kind of like that element of it. It's very committed to that. So it's a pretty like relatively standard like action movie plot. But the action is pretty well done. And Frank Grillo is one of my favorite actors, like one of my favorite character actors. And so to see him in a lead role like this, just kicking ass, is always a lot of fun. So anyway, yeah. So that's Wheelman. I got three more movies to talk about, Mike.
I
know.
Let me buckle up.
The first of which is one I was really excited about. This one played at Sundance way back in the day, by which I mean January.
It was another lifetime ago.
Exactly. This one is called Brigsby Bear.
We're safe for now, but I let the whole galaxy down. I don't get it. The prophecy said if we activate the Sordis crystal inside the temple, we could destroy Sun Snatcher.
Perhaps there's a lesson here, Brigsby. When solving for X on a one-dimensional plane where minus 1 by the magnitude of 1 equals minus X, always solve for vector R.
Until our next adventure, remember, prophecy is meaningless. Trust only your familial unit. And please, discard leftover food rations in the yellow bin, not the red one. Goodbye!
Which is directed by Dave McCary. Do you know Brigsby Bear at all, Mike? Have you heard of that coming out of Sundance?
Don't think I have, no.
Okay. Are you familiar with Kyle Mooney from Saturday Night Live?
Yes.
Okay. If you're a fan of Kyle Mooney's weird 1255 sketches in SNL, like the really oddball esoteric sketches that he does like at the end of the night, you will like this movie. So it's a movie made for me, and it's basically a feature-length version of that. I fucking loved it. essentially, this movie, Kyle Mooney stars as a guy obsessed with a children's TV show that no one has ever heard of and decides to make a movie that concludes the series. And there's more to that story that I don't want to discuss here because the discovery of what this movie actually is pretty delightful. But it's got a great supporting cast. Mark Hamill is in this movie, which was pretty cool. And Matt Walsh and McKaylee Watkins are in this. And it's just a lot of fun. Like, if you were, like, I mean, Dave McCary and Kyle Mooney have been working on SNL for many years now. And the other members of their sketch group are in this, including Beck Bennett, who's also on SNL. It's really great. It's just so weird and oddball. And it has that same kind of sense of humor that you get out of those Kyle Mooney sketches that are always cut for time, you know?
Yeah.
Like the stuff that pops up on YouTube, like the Wednesday after. And it's like, hey, this was, you know, played a dress rehearsal, but didn't make the actual show because nobody wants to watch it.
Yep.
This is that movie, and it's pretty wonderful. I was a big fan of Brigsby Bear, and I think you would be too, Mike, if you gave it a shot.
All right.
But yeah.
How pleasant.
Indeed. Also, I saw Lady Bird this past weekend, which has been getting phenomenal reviews across the gate. I don't know if you saw this today, but Mike, today, Lady Bird, still at 100% of Rotten Tomatoes. with over like 165 or something reviews, which makes it currently the movie with the most reviews to have 100% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Even that asshole said it was good. I can't remember his name.
Armand White, I think you're talking about.
Yes, that's the one.
Yeah, the previous movie to hold that record, Toy Story 2.
Wow.
Yeah, so this is the new movie written and directed by Greta Gerwig, who's one of my favorite writers and actresses, here making her solo directorial debut. She co-directed a movie back in like 2008, which I haven't seen actually, but I've heard it's pretty good. And this movie has gotten just incredible praise. It stars Saoirse Ronan as a high school senior in Sacramento circa like 2002, 2003.
I want to go where culture is, like
how
New
in the
York,
world did I raise such
or
a
at least
snob.
Connecticut or New Hampshire, well, where writers live in the
get
woods.
Get into those schools anyway.
Mom,
you can't even pass your driver's test.
Because you wouldn't let me practice.
The way that you work, or the way that you don't work, you're not even worth state tuition, Christine.
My name is Lady Bird.
Well, actually, it's not, and it's ridiculous.
Call me Lady Bird, like
Christine.
You said you would.
You should just go to City College. You know, with your work ethic, just go to City College, and then to jail, and then back to City College, and then maybe you'd learn to pull yourself up and not expect everybody to do everything.
And what I really like about Greta Gerwig's work is that it is often very funny. Like Mistress America, which she did with Noah Baumbach, is basically a screwball comedy in its second half. And it's super great. It's super funny. It's still my favorite of her movies and honestly one of my favorite movies of the past few years. But all of her stuff also comes from like very great pain. If you took out Saoirse Ronan's character in this movie, every other character is going through some incredibly depressing and crushing shit. And... and it's so sad. Like, it's so sad, but the movie like is funny. Like, it's very funny, but it's also like funny in spite of the sadness. Like, it never like outweighs the melancholy, and the movie is ultimately I'm not gonna say a tragedy, but it is very sad up until its final moments, you know, and it's it's sort of uplifting towards the end. But anyway, this is a really great movie. It's very well written, and I think it's a great debut for Greta Gerwig as a director, and I hope to see more from her in this vein, because I think she's really great. I think this is going to be huge at the Oscars this year. I think it has a really strong chance at that anyway. And then finally, I want to talk about my favorite movie of the ones that I'm talking about today. Which is Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
I'd do anything to catch the guy who did it, Mrs. Hayes, but when the DNA don't match no one who's ever been arrested, and when the DNA don't match any other crime nationwide, and when there wasn't a single eyewitness from the time she left your house to the time we found her, well, right now, there ain't too much more we can do.
Could pull blood from every man and boy in this town over the age of 8.
Their civil rights laws prevents that, Mrs. Hayes. And what if he was just passing through town?
Pull blood from every man in the country, then.
And what if he was just passing through the country?
If it was me, I'd start up a database. Every male baby that's born, stick him on it. And as soon as he'd done something wrong, cross-reference it, make 100% certain it was a correct match, then kill him.
Yeah, well, there's... definitely civil rights laws prevents that.
Now, you've heard of this one, I'm sure, right, Mike?
I have heard of it, yeah. I don't really know a whole lot about it still in my efforts to remain unsullied a lot of movies. So, like, I've heard a lot of hype and that this movie is really good, but I don't know why or what it's about or anything yet.
Okay, well, this is written and directed by Martin McDonagh, who was the writer-director of In Bruges and Seven Psychopaths. And I think... this is my favorite screenplay out of any movie I've seen this year. I dug the hell out of it. It's a film that feels incredibly relevant and vital, and which paints a portrait of America at its most extreme. This is a movie about Frances McDormand plays this mother whose daughter was killed several months ago. And the police chief in her the police department in her town has not been able to find a killer. So she's frustrated and she rents out these billboards essentially condemning the chief of the town, asking why there has been no arrest or no progress in the case. And it kind of becomes like an overnight sensation in the town. It causes a lot of controversy. And this is a incredibly dark comedy. It's comedy at its darkest. It's an incredibly sharp satire. Frances McDormand is terrific in the lead role. Sam Rockwell is in this movie, given a really challenging role, and I think does great work with it. And there has been some controversy surrounding the film's attitude towards some of the issues it presents, because it really tackles head-on things like police brutality and racial profiling, and it appears to offer a redemption arc to a character who doesn't deserve one. But that's kind of what I like about it. It presents every side of this issue and doesn't offer any easy answers. It just kind of forces you to confront your own feelings on a subject, and at the same time hear the other takes on the subject. And there's so much going on in this movie, and I think it is if you don't know what you're going in for, because I saw this with a few people, and one friend just was not that into it. He was like, "Yeah, it was okay. I just didn't feel like I got what I was expecting." He was expecting like a thriller that had them solving the case, and this really isn't about
right.
That's just kind of the backdrop for this kind of moody character piece. But it's also, you know, a Martin McDonagh movie, so there's a lot of like really crass humor. There's a lot of like really effectively deployed swear words that are really great, and a lot of really terrific lines. And again, Sam Rockwell is at times hilarious, at times terrifying in this movie. And you know, Woody Harrelson is terrific as the police chief, and Francis McDormand again. John Hawkes is in this movie. Peter Dinklage is in this movie. This is going to be a movie that I'm talking about for a long time, I think. So that's Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. And with that, Mike, I believe we can move on. Let's move on into our featured review of Justice League.
We're asking people we don't know to risk their lives.
Strong man is strong as alone. You ever heard that?
That's not a saying. That's the opposite of what the saying is.
Divided, we are not enough. The world needs Superman. I made him a promise. Why I brought you together.
Ride ain't over yet.
My man.
All right, that was from the trailer for Justice League, a new movie written by Chris Terrio, Joss Whedon, and Zack Snyder, and directed by Zack Snyder. It stars Ben Affleck, Henry Cavill, Gal Gadot, Ezra Miller, Jason Momoa, Ray Fisher, Amy Adams, Jeremy Irons, Diane Lane, Connie Nielsen, J.K. Simmons, and Kieran Hines, among others. And the IMDb plot synopsis for Justice League reads, "Fueled by his restored faith in humanity and inspired by Superman's selfless act, Bruce Wayne enlists the help of his newfound ally, Diana Prince, to face an even greater enemy." Now, what I like about the IMDb page is that it says to face an even greater enemy, the subject being Superman. Superman was the enemy, and now they must face an even greater one.
Correct. Yeah, that's amazing.
So... We have had mixed feelings about the DC universe up to this point, Mike, to say the least. I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think you kind of like Man of Steel, right? Are you?
It's been a while since I've seen it, so I'm gonna say sure. I'll give it the benefit of the doubt.
I'm not a huge fan of Man of Steel. There are like select scenes in the movie that I do kind of like, but overall, not a big Man of Steel fan. We're both not fans of Batman vs Superman. I know that much. We reviewed that on this podcast a while back. And I know we're both not fans of Suicide Squad either, because we reviewed that one on this podcast a while back. We did both like Wonder Woman, which came out earlier this year, which you can check out on filmbook.com. We reviewed that as well. So this is the movie that is kind of is meant to be like the culmination of everything that's happened, right? This is Justice League. This is their Avengers. This is the movie that should be the DC Avengers. And I will be honest, I saw this a little over a week ago, and I'm struggling to remember anything that happened.
I saw this a scant 20 hours ago, probably. And yeah, no, same boat.
I think a lot of the problem here, I didn't like Man of Steel or Batman vs Superman, but at least they were like about something. You know, they felt like they were ambitious. You know. They felt like they were ambitious works. Like Zack Snyder clearly had his directorial voice on those movies. He was swinging for the fences, and they did not work at all. But you know, they felt like they were trying for something. You know, their whole thing was like, you know, even if their only objective was to not be like Marvel, to do their own thing, at least they were doing their own thing. You know, say what you will about the tenets of National Socialism, dude. At least it's an ethos. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you're right.
And Justice League, by comparison, is just—it's a movie that feels focus grouped to death. You know, it never has like an identity, because either no one at any point knew what they wanted this movie to be, or because the studio wanted it to be bland and inoffensive enough just to keep the franchise rolling. I don't know. Did you feel the same way coming out of this, Mike?
Yes. I think the direct quote that I could pull out my unlock my phone, but I think I said it was mostly dumb but had some fun stuff. And that's basically it. It's just we've got all these characters. Let's just smash them together. Oh, look, an alien thing. All right. We got dangerously close. Actually, in fact, we even get giant beam in the sky a couple times, right. Which is check that box off. check off large ensemble cast. Yeah, I mean, it just feels like a thing we've done. How many Marvel movies are there?
Something like 17, 18.
So it's a thing we've done around 17 or 18 times already.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what's happening here. Basically. Yeah. I think Film Crit Hulk, had the best tweet ever about this kind of similar subject earlier this year, a couple weeks ago, maybe at this point, was everyone wants to make the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but no one wants to take the time to make Iron Man. I don't care about any of these characters really. I mean, I do, I guess, cause it's like Batman and stuff. But other than that, there's no reason for me to be invested or involved in any of this. And it just feels it feels so silly. And I don't mean that in like the lighthearted, you know, like Joss Whedon way, even though that's in there a tiny bit. You know, we have the film opens with, you know, the shot of a pigeon coop where we see the giant newspaper that says Superman, or the newspaper headline that says Superman is dead. And then there's a thing with that happens on the rooftop, and one of the characters says, "This is all because Superman's dead, isn't it?" And then I think we get maybe one more scene where they say that, and then the opening credits happen, which is just a montage showing us that Superman's dead. So we spend about 5 minutes just reminding us that Superman's dead when we could have just had the opening credits and got the whole point across.
I think my favorite, going back to that newspaper, I wanted to throw this out because I had forgotten about this until right now. It says like Superman dead, and it says something like, are they going back to their home planet or something like that? And it's a picture of Superman, David Bowie, and Prince.
Prince. Yeah, that's during the opening credits. Yeah, we get.
It's like, are you fucking kidding me? Like these people ritchy. These people just died in real life. Stop. Abort movie. Stop. but yeah, I will say this for Justice League. It is mercifully short at only 2 hours.
Yes, that's definitely true. Yeah,
but in doing so, it also felt very rushed, and it felt very content just being a watered down version of the Avengers. You know, because that is essentially what this is. This is a movie about a group of superheroes, one of which is a billionaire, one of which is an immortal being, and one of which sees himself as a monster as a result of his powers, coming together to stop a group of faceless aliens that are in control of a big glowing box in a movie co-written by Joss Whedon. Like, this is Avengers Lite, you know?
Yeah.
And it's you know, that's the thing. The Avengers, you know, that was the sixth. This is basically the movie. Like, Avengers was movie number six. This is movie number five in their respective franchises. And the Avengers came out. You know, they did two Iron Mans. They did the Incredible Hulk. They did Thor and Captain America. They did all these, like, solo movies that led up to the Avengers and introduced you to all these heroes so that when it was time for Avengers to come out, you knew all these characters going into it already, you know?
Yes.
And I'm not necessarily against the idea of just putting out a Justice League movie and, like, throwing them out there, but you need to have some semblance of, like, an introduction to who these people are.
We get that in the most expository, like, your mother once told you, and, like, every character has that scene. Well, the Flash, Cyborg, and Aquaman all have those scenes because we haven't seen them yet before, where we have to have one other character important to their backstory explain the backstory to the person that it's about.
Yeah, but that's the thing. I feel like I was zoning out during those scenes because they weren't interesting at all.
Oh, no, yeah, no, that was meant to be a critique.
Exactly. But it's, you know, when you watch something like Ocean's 11, right. you don't need 11 solo movies leading up to Ocean's 11 because Ocean's 11 introduces you to all the characters pretty quickly. You understand what their function is on the team, and you just roll with it. This movie doesn't really give you that. right? It just kind of gives you these characters. It kind of introduces you to them. Like, you kind of see, like, Ben Affleck show up and, like, talk to Aquaman for a little while. And then Aquaman's gone for a while, and then he comes back. But you don't really get, like, a demonstration of his powers until, like, halfway through the movie or stuff like that. Or when you do, it's, like, this weird underwater sequence with no other characters that you've ever met. So it's, like, what do you care? Why do I care about that person?
Yeah.
It's very strange. And I want to talk about Steppenwolf a little bit. Who is a non-entity of a villain, like less than a non-entity. He is a nothing. He's a nothing burger of a character. You know, you could remove him from this movie and it would be exactly the same. I think
you could just say
alien invasion and like that. That's it.
If the cubes acted on their own sentience, it'd be more interesting.
Yeah, you're probably right, actually.
That would be pretty dope.
I really think he is like the worst superhero movie villain since Malekith and Thor 2. And that is my bar for like worst movie villain of all time.
Yeah.
And arguably a bigger waste of its actor, which is a huge bar to clear. Because at least with Malekith, like Christopher Eccleston, you know, you didn't know, you couldn't tell it was him and he was speaking in Elvish, but at least he was physically on set. Like he was, like he was covered in makeup, but he was physically there. This is, you know, a CG creation. And it's like, why get Kieran Hines for this? You know, he's an actor of note. He was Mance Radar in Game of Thrones. Like he's somebody who's, you know, has been around for a long time. And they even like modulate his voice. So it's like, what is even the point? Yeah. Of that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I had no idea that's who that was.
Exactly.
Like, why? Yeah, and he is the least interesting. I mean, it's the most run-of-the-mill, like just, what do you think a villain's going to do, Mike? Like, just generic archetype villain.
Yeah, take over.
Conquer the planet? All right.
Here we go.
Sure. That's the one.
Yeah, I mean.
Will he travel on a big beam in the sky? Check it off.
Give that man $60 million. Yeah, I don't know, man. It just felt very it's just like everything about this movie feels like it's an also-ran. Like it just feels like, you know, everything like just doesn't just like we've already done this in 7 other movies.
Yeah.
And all those movies did it better than this, you know.
Yeah, I mean that said though, there are still like glittering moments of fun, I guess. Sure. And that's kind of it. That's kind of my only reaction.
Yeah, I feel like fun. And I, you know, if you look at the reviews and stuff online, like they were marginally better this time around than they have been for like Batman vs Superman or Suicide Squad or something like that. And I think that is because this is a it's not a compelling story, but it is like a story with a beginning, middle, and end, I guess. You know?
Mm-hmm. It's got structure.
In a sense. I'm not going to go as far as to say it's got structure, but like it definitely starts and it definitely ends. So there's that.
Yeah,
there is at least a semblance of an arc there for some of the characters. But I think what was I trying to say?
That's what I feel like that's the movie. That whole thing you just did, where you were starting to say a point and you were like, well, but this other thing, and then you forgot where you were going. That was it. We can thanks for listening, everyone. We're out. Stay tuned for next week.
You're not wrong. That is exactly what Justice League is like. It's me trailing off in the middle of a sentence. But yeah, I think you know, a lot of the problems you can have with this movie, like I think this DC universe has been such a reactionary franchise in the worst possible way. Like they learn the wrongest lessons from every single movie. that they make. So people like had a pretty like divisive reaction to Man of Steel, right? And so Warner Brothers' reaction was like, fuck it, let's bring in Batman. Like they were like panicking, like they knew Batman was bankable, so they threw in Batman. Like the Avengers had just been a big hit, so it's like we'll do our own cinematic universe. Like, and Man of Steel, if you watch that movie, it does not hint to a larger universe at all. It's just a Superman movie. And I almost like that movie a little bit more now because of it. Like. Because it is just like an isolated thing, almost disconnected from the rest of this horrible DC universe. But then, you know, so Man of Steel came out. People didn't react well to it. They added Batman. Batman vs. Superman comes out. People didn't react well to it. And they were like, oh, well, this is like people are like, you know, a lot of the complaints were like, well, this is really dark and like there should be some kind of lightness to this. And so as a result, they re-edited Suicide Squad.
Yep.
Which was intended to be this like relatively dark, gritty movie and turned it into this like big bubbly Guardians of the Galaxy clone. And that didn't work, you know. So at this point, you know, they're heavy in production on Justice League and they are just scrambling around trying to figure out what to do. You know, Zack Snyder had his own vision for what these characters were like that was present in Man of Steel and Batman vs. Superman. And it was clear DC wanted to go in a different direction after Batman vs. Superman came out. So it was like heavily re-edited because this movie has been filming for like a year and a half. Like it's been going back and forth for reshoots and stuff like that. And you know, so everything just feels like it's a clusterfuck. And I would love to read the book about the making of this movie because it sounds insane.
I can't imagine what's going on over there.
This could be like the Hearts of Darkness of superhero movies, you know, like, and I would be all about it. I would read the hell out of that book or watch the hell out of the documentary or whatever. But it's so much stuff went into this. And this movie cost over $300 million and it looks like shit. Like it looks so bad, right?
Yeah, that's a thing we've talked about it for almost every DC movie we've talked about. It's just, why are these movies look like just poop? They're just our poop. They're just poop movies. I don't get it.
Yeah. I think a lot of this, you know, one of the big things about the behind the scenes, and we talked about this before, Zack Snyder had to drop out about, you know, back in like March because of a family tragedy. And DC brought in Joss Whedon to sort of help salvage the movie. He had already been doing like uncredited rewrites on the script. And they brought him in to direct the reshoots. So from what I understand, Whedon reshot about 20% of the movie, and he rewrote enough of the script where he got a writing credit on it.
Right.
So there's that. But I think what you get out of this is the Zack Snyder versus the Joss Whedon of it all. These are directors who have two very different styles. You know, Zack Snyder has this big operatic style, this like dark and gritty thing that he's going for. And Whedon has, you know, that kind of like quippy, whimsical Whedon thing that he does. He has fun with his characters. He specializes in like banter and stuff like that. And these styles clash all throughout this movie, I think. Like you can pretty much tell whose ideas are whose. If you know enough of both directors' work, which I've seen pretty much everything both guys have done. So I think I can kind of pick it out. And I was thinking like maybe I won't be able to, you know, like this movie will like they'll have weaved it in like maybe DC is so expertly telling the story that they like nothing will stick out like a sore thumb. You know?
Oh yes, if there's one studio that has finesse, Mike, it's Warner Brothers in relation to the DC movies.
Yeah, and these things, like the scenes that are like clearly Joss Whedon stuff, like I kind of like them. They're
probably all the quote unquote fun parts.
He adds like some character moments that kind of work for me. There are some solid character moments throughout the movie, but it just feels like it's not enough. You know, it feels like it's too little, too late at this point. And it's just very bad at introducing you to characters, you know, unlike like in the Avengers, everyone gets their intro moment, right? Like Hulk is in another country and he shows up when like Black Widow recruits him. You see Black Widow on this mission in Russia, right? And Captain America's at the gym, but we don't have movies to go on for Aquaman, the Flash, or Cyborg, and the movie never really gives you much to go on with them. So like the first time you see Aquaman, Bruce Wayne shows up at like the surface world where he's hanging out in, and he's in like the background of a shot, like. You know what I mean? He's in like he's the back of a scene and like while Bruce Wayne is talking, and then it cuts to like Jason Momoa's face. And you don't see like you don't get like any indication of who this character is until he swims away. And even then you're like, you don't know why is that important? Like you kind of get from the conversation, like, yeah, we know he's Aquaman, but like we don't know this world has never been this character has never been introduced to us in any fashion other than a 30-second clip in Batman vs Superman.
I was gonna say we got him in the sizzle reel, Mike, don't worry.
The trailer for this movie that was in that one. I don't know. And it was kind of the same deal with the Flash and Cyborg. I think out of all the characters, I think Cyborg is the most useless to me in this movie. Like the Flash like does solid the comic relief stuff, and Jason Momoa is like kind of fun as Aquaman. He has like this frat boy thing going on that is enjoyable.
It's very, very weirdly like self-aware about all that stuff. Like I really liked The Flash, and he was a lot of fun. You know, he's that's the most Joss Whedon character of them all, as far as I'm concerned. Cyborg is the classic, but is this really a gift superhero? And then I think that's an actual quote by accident I said. but then we get. Yeah, ooh, look out. And then we get Jason Momoa, where, like, there's a scene where he grabs a bottle of whiskey, and he walks in slow motion into the ocean over Icky Thump by the White Stripes.
To be fair, I added half a star for that, because I fucking love Icky Thump.
It was such a gratuitous, ridiculous thing. Like, it doesn't fit his character. He's, like, this weird Icelandic, where he's going, like, you know, whatever. He's in this weird, like, Norse Icelandic thing, and it's just like, sure, we own the rights. Warner Brother owns the rights to that song. Let's fucking use it, I guess. Like, I mean, it's cool, but it's just such, like, a weird, self-aware thing where it's relying on audience knowledge of who these actors are playing these characters before we actually get explained that in the movie at all.
Yeah.
Which, like, is fine, I guess, whatever.
Yeah, I think all the actors are basically fine. Like, I think with Jason Momoa does pretty good work. Ezra Miller is solid comic relief. Ray Fisher gets nothing to do with Cyborg, but he's fine. Gal Gadot crushes it. Like, she's very good. And the best scene in the movie, I think, is just the Wonder Woman short film that's in the beginning, where it's, you know, her.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah.
Her stopping the bank robbery. Like, hey, that's fun. This is a cool.
Yeah.
Was that a follow up to the ending of the original Wonder Woman? Like, of Wonder Woman? Doesn't she show up to, like, isn't there, like, an alarm going off at the end of Wonder Woman and she, like, kind of answers the call and that's the credits?
Oh, yeah, maybe. I think. No, because it starts with her, like, up on top of that, like, statue in this. Remember, she's, like, up on the Lady Liberty thing or whatever?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Or not justice, I guess. The scales of justice and the sword and all that stuff. But, yeah, I think the lesson that DC should have learned was make Wonder Woman the main character of this movie instead of Batman.
If they had called this movie Wonder Woman 2, it would have made $50 million more dollars. Like,
absolutely. 100%. If it was about Wonder Woman, taking up the call and forming Justice League, this movie is a million times better instead of it being about Batman needs to be justice or whatever the fuck, whatever. and Wonder Woman still dealing with that, like, coming out of the shadows thing that is at the end, even though at the end of Wonder Woman, she's done that already or is deciding to do that. But in this movie, it's still, like, up in the air. It's just all over the place.
Yeah, I do kind of like the arc that is kind of – the way that Wonder Woman's arc has kind of played out over the three movies we've seen her in. Because, like, Batman vs. Superman is her, like, re-entering the world, right? Like, re-entering the world. And then you kind of get this feature-length flashback detailing, like, her origin story and why she left the world in the first place.
Right.
And then this movie is kind of her, like, fully accepting her role as, like, the new – guardian of the world or whatever. Like, I don't know, I kind of like the way that it plays out for her in these movies, and I don't think Batman vs. Superman did a great job with her character at all, but just, like, kind of retroactively, like, it kind of works in that way. And I did like that this movie kind of called back to Wonder Woman
quite frequently actually.
They kind of call back to Chris Pine's character a lot. And Ben Affleck, I mean, what'd you think of Affleck in this movie? Because I think he was fine, but I feel like he's looking off screen in between every take trying to figure out how he can get the hell out of here.
Like, yeah, he's checking his exits and planning his route between every take. Yeah, he doesn't seem to really be interested at all. I mean, I don't know, which I guess, like, is Batman. Right.
I feel like, you know, I've seen him as, honestly, like, I remember thinking, like, I didn't really think much of him in Batman vs. Superman. I didn't think much of him in this movie. I think that his best performance as Batman was in Suicide Squad for, like, the two scenes that he was in. He's actually, like, I feel like he was, like, all in on that. Like, he felt like Batman in those scenes. He felt like Bruce Wayne in those scenes. But in these movies, like, those feature length ones that he's in, I don't know, he just feels like Ben Affleck. He doesn't feel like a Batman to me. I just don't see it, you know. And he's just not working for me. And maybe it's because, you know, I was raised on the Christian Bale ones, and I feel like Christian Bale is my ideal Bruce Wayne. Like, he is so good in those roles. But I can see other actors as Batman, though. Like, I can watch the Michael Keaton Batmans and be like, yeah, it's Batman or whatever. But yeah, I don't know. He feels more like George Clooney in Batman and Robin, almost. Like, somebody who is, like, you know, not really playing Bruce Wayne or Batman. He's just playing himself, you know?
Right. Yeah, I am interested in that kind of, you know, Batman in his later years and, like, is kind of not washed up, but, you know, he's hurting, you know, all this stuff. And, you know, as opposed to the Christian Bale Batman, I feel, or I guess especially the Dark Knight, where he's, like, you know, in his prime and all this stuff.
Yeah.
I am interested in that kind of, you know, coming out of retirement sort of story.
Yeah. Well, that was The Dark Knight Rises. That was that story.
Yeah, that's fair. That's a good point. Yeah,
I honestly think that DC kind of shot themselves in the foot by starting their Batman off like that, you know, because you basically lose like 20 to 30 years of potential Batman stories you can use.
I was definitely having that thought. There's a throwaway line that Jeremy Irons says where he's like, oh, it makes you long for the days where the best gadgets your enemy had was a wind-up penguin or something along those lines, right. You know, something like that. But yeah, like, this world and this Batman, that's done. All that stuff is gone. There's no Batman villains left, I assume.
Well, I guess Joker's still around Joker. Somewhere.
Yeah, that's true. Who cares about him, though? Yeah, but yeah, it's just a weird way to, like, set up that character and this universe where I guess we're only going to be fighting these, like, weird cosmic things that can fight Superman. Like, yeah. You know, like, and
so
I don't know.
Yeah. So it's like, why is Batman even here? Like, what is he contributing to the team other than like a place to hang out? You know, like,
that's, yeah,
that's kind of it. What did you think of Henry Cavill in this movie, Mike? Just out of curiosity. Now, I feel like it's not a spoiler to say he's in the movie because obviously he's in the movie.
Right. I'm going to say he feels really dead, but but kind of, yeah.
Tired over here.
Yeah, yeah. There's like a – it's just weird. But yeah, I don't know. He feels very superfluous to the story.
Yeah.
Other than he's the complete linchpin and the only one that can solve their problem. But he's just there for most of it and barely at that.
Yeah. However, when he is there, I feel like he's finally getting to play a version of Superman that I'd like to see more of in these movies. Like, this is not the Superman that I watched in Man of Steel and Batman Superman. This is like a new kind of fresher, like more of a like friendly Superman. like a happy Superman almost. Like,
oh, you mean the way the character is?
Yeah, like some, you know, something that's much closer to the character that I would like to see in these movies. Mm-hmm. And so I'm glad we finally got there. It only took us, you know, until the end of the third movie that he was in to to get to that point.
Yeah.
But still, you know, I think that's cool. And we'll talk more about that in spoilers, I think. That's probably where to get into that.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
Other stuff, though. I want to talk about Danny Elfman's score for this movie a little bit. So Danny Elfman did the score for this movie. And it contains echoes of previous scores that he's done. There's a bit in the movie where he does the Batman theme from Tim Burton's Batman. Yeah, that actually plays
interesting.
That plays over the end credits. I think it plays a couple times throughout the movie. And he also kind of does a subtle recreation of John Williams' Superman theme when Superman shows up for the first time. And it's kind of like this, like very quiet, kind of like reworked version of the Superman theme. I really wish they had gone full on with the Superman theme because that would earn like an extra star for me.
Yeah. Why would you not? That's,
yeah, exactly. Weird. But at the same time, I feel like it's sort of like it speaks to how much DC is just desperate to please you. But it's just like, hey, we're putting in these classic themes. You like those? Please like this movie kind of thing. it just feels like every move they make reeks of like desperation at this point. And it's honestly like sad. It's sad to watch. You know,
Marvel
is putting out three movies a year and two of them are Guardians of the Galaxy and Thor, like,
yeah.
And DC is like barely struggling to like, you know, get a movie with Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman into a coherent narrative. Like,
yeah, I mean, this is the tentpole DC story is Justice League and they just can't do it.
It's amazing. And I was actually watching there's these old YouTube videos I used to watch called "Hi, I'm a Marvel and I'm a DC," and they were like parodies of the old Mac and PC commercials.
Uh-huh.
And they recently did one for their 10th anniversary, and I happened to watch it. I hadn't watched them in years, but it like came up in my thing. I was like, "Hey, 10th anniversary!" And it showed a clip from the original one, and it's a Spider-Man and Superman talking to each other, and they're talking about the upcoming slates for all their movies. And even back then, in 2007, Spider-Man's talking about like, "Yeah, Marvel's working on like these new Iron Man and Ant-Man and Thor movies and all that stuff. What are you guys working on?" And Superman's like, "Well, we're talking about maybe doing the possibility of hiring somebody to write what potentially could be a Justice League movie in the next 10 years or more, perhaps." And
yep.
They finally made it, but man, it took it just did not work. I'm very sick of, and you know, here's the thing. This almost feels like the closing of a certain chapter in the DC universe, right? It feels like the end of the Snyderverse era of DC in certain respect to me. I think the idea at this point is DC wanted to put this movie out there because it was already in production and kind of had no choice. But about halfway through, they kind of reworked what their vision is for their company and what their universe should look like. And I think it's going to be much more focused on what Wonder Woman was like, you know?
Yeah.
And so this kind of feels like the closing chapter of the Snyderverse, taking its cue from Wonder Woman. So like, yeah, give me that James Wan Aquaman, give me that Wonder Woman 2, give me that Joss Whedon Batgirl. And, you know, maybe we'll be getting somewhere. But I'm very sick of like the DC Ed Wood esque, like my next film will be better type attitude.
Holy shit.
You know?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Cause like, you know, like Marvel got to where they are by making good movies in the first place. Like you, mm-hmm. That's kind of the thing. Like there were missteps along the way, you know, Iron Man 2 is not great. The Incredible Hulk's not great, but, they put in the work, they put in the planning and it paid off. Like their universe is the biggest thing in movies right now. And if DC could just do, like, it's hard to make a good movie.
Just do the impossible thing.
It's hard to make a good movie, and you shouldn't be just trying to replicate Marvel. You should be trying to do your own thing. Right. But by, like, start by just, like, hiring, you know, talented people to who care about what they're doing to, you know, make something cool. Like, you know, like, take some risks, do some cool ideas. And I think Man of Steel and Batman vs Superman was a risk that kind of didn't pay off. But, you know, Justice League feels like the opposite direction. Like, they played it so safe that, like, who could possibly like this?
Yeah. I think we're going to have some discussions and spoilers about where the future might go for this. But, yeah, I definitely agree that they went with, like, the kind of milquetoast route, and it just didn't pay off.
Right. So, I guess we should get into spoilers, Mike. Let's do that. Let's get into spoilers for Justice League, starting right now. So, spoilers for Justice League, starting right now. So, Mike, a lot of this movie centers around the group trying to bring Superman back from the dead, right? That's kind of the...
Yes.
It's almost like the actual full arc of this movie is that. And
well, I mean, you say that, but really, that pops up and 10 minutes later it's resolved. So, like, not even, though.
But I feel like a lot of the movie is focused on it, though, isn't it? Like,
it's kind of it's sort of the emotional arc of, like, man, all this bad stuff is happening because Superman's gone. We need to, you know, live up to his image and, you know, the kind of hopeful message of Wonder Woman and all that stuff. We spend, 45 minutes getting the band together. Batman's like, now that we're together, we should resurrect Superman. And about 10 to 15 minutes later, they do it.
Yeah.
And then we have the big fight at the end. And, like, that's the whole movie.
Right. What can I ask, what does Superman add to that fight that the group wasn't already providing? Like, what was that?
He's super strong. And that's it.
I feel like he didn't add much to, like, you know, what was the point of bringing him back? Like, he...
I think he comes back just to make the visual gag of him carrying a building while Flash pushes a truck.
Yeah, that was pretty good. I did enjoy that.
I mean, that was pretty funny, but yeah.
But anyway, yeah. I mean, I think my favorite part about the whole scene where they resurrect Superman is, like, when Superman, you know, bolts out of the thing and, you know, he's like evil Superman and he shows up at, like, the statue or whatever. And,
yeah.
And the four of the Justice League heroes, Wonder Woman, Flash, Cyborg, and Aquaman, all show up immediately. And then Batman has to show up late, like, by, like, jogging there or something. Because, you know, they can all, like, super speed or fly or whatever, and it's just, like, and they don't, it would have been a great visual gag if they just showed Batman jogging over to the scene.
Jogging down the street. Yeah, that would have been amazing.
But he just kind of shows up just a little bit later than everyone else. And it was, like, all the way across town or something. Like, it wasn't like it was close by, so I don't know how he got there so fast. But, I mean, that whole sequence, like, you know, it's all right. Superman was fighting them. There was that. I did enjoy Ezra Miller's kind of, like, I'm shitting my pants look when Superman
yes.
makes eye contact with him. Also, they call back "Do You Bleed" from Batman vs Superman, which was weird.
Like, there's a couple really weird moments with Superman. There, that one, because he reads it. He delivers that line in the weirdest, like, Evil Dead 2 kind of way. Like, do you bleed? And then when Lois Lane is like, you smell good. Like, what?
Yeah,
that was such a weird.
Especially because he just came out of the ground.
Yeah.
For like 6 months or whatever. Like, how long was he dead? He was dead for a while.
For a while, yeah. Super odd.
He's just mostly dead, though. He wasn't full dead. But also, I think what's also kind of weird about this is that Batman vs Superman, the very end of that movie, implies that Superman will come back to life. Like, it has the rocks rising stuff like that. This movie does nothing with that. Like, it
does... And that implies he's already alive again.
Yeah. That's like, the ending of Batman vs Superman implies, like, oh, he's already coming back to life. What a crazy thing. And this movie just doesn't acknowledge that at all. Nope, he's dead. Those rocks didn't rise. You didn't see that.
I honestly thought I imagined that after this movie. I was like, I remember this really cool, like, high-speed shot with the rocks, you know, Super 8 4K, whatever, like, awesome. And then I was like, but maybe I made that up. I don't like, that doesn't happen anywhere in this movie.
But I think my favorite thing about that whole sequence is that they have to use the Mother Box to resurrect Superman, right? That's, like, the thing. And they do so. Superman bolts, and all the heroes leave, and they just leave the Mother Box unattended.
Yeah.
And then, like, and you don't even see Steppenwolf take the box. It's just the next scene. Cyborg is like, "Man, Steppenwolf got the third Mother Box."
It might as well be, yeah.
And it's like, wait, and I had to do a double take. Like, when did he do what? When did that happen?
I think they show us a shot of the beam off in the distance in the sky, and then they can, then that's it. But like,
man, I can't believe he got the third mother box. That is unfortunate.
Yes.
But speaking of the mother boxes, I wanted to talk about that a little bit because this movie is very exposition heavy. For something that can just be this box bad. This guy wants it. Don't let him get it. Like that could be.
That would have been it.
But this is so exposition heavy, in fact, that it stops to literally just reenact the prologue of Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring, about halfway through the movie. So it's like one mother. They talk about like one mother box went to the Amazons. One went to the Atlanteans. Five were given to the elves. Yeah. Seven to the dwarves. Like.
Yeah, pretty much.
And it's such a weird, like, it almost feels like it's a direct homage to the Fellowship of the Ring.
I mean, it might be.
It might be. But, like, why not put that scene at the beginning of the movie? Like, when that information is relevant to us, so we just, like, know the information going in. So when we see the mother box, we're like, hey, shit, that, like, that,
that's,
that,
the thing.
One of the things. That's the thing they were talking about in the thing.
Yeah, no, that would have been good. But we had to get the opening credits 5 minutes in. And then, yeah, just like just everything about this movie is bonkers like that. And I do love that we get that during that opening scene with Batman on the roof, when the like the parademon, which is the, like the dumbest name for anything ever, like explodes into goop and then like leaves the singe marks of the three boxes for some reason, like in the wall in the goop after he blows up. And then that never happens again. And like, why would a thing blow up leave the marks of the thing it wants? Like, that doesn't make any sense ever.
Yeah. I think one of the also the things, like, this is theoretically a follow up to Batman vs. Superman. All that dark side stuff, Batman vs. Superman, just never pops up at all. Right.
Well, there is a scene towards the end, you know, Steppenwolf's demise. At some point where he's like, yeah, something, he, I almost said something, dark side.
something repeats.
but like literally though, he just says the name dark, like for dark side. And then like, it just isn't passing. And it's still irrelevant to everything else that's happened for the last hour and 45 minutes or whatever.
I mean, in the movie. I think what I heard, I mean, originally this was planned as a 2-part movie. So this was 2017, and Justice League Part 2 is going to be 2019, both going to be Zack Snyder. This was back when DC was like outlining, like, yeah, we're going to do a Cyborg movie and Green Lantern movie and all that stuff. Like, that's like, yeah, sure, DC. Like, but just Justice League Part 2 was part of that plan. And from what I've been reading, like, they scrapped Justice League 2 and, like, condensed the narrative into this one movie. But I think the idea was that Steppenwolf would be the villain of this movie, and that would lead up into Darkseid and Justice League 2.
Right.
And also, like, the whole Superman coming back thing would have been, like, the entire arc of this movie. But then when he shows up at the end, it would be evil. Like, he would be an evil Superman and be working for Darkseid at the end. And then that would be, like, the cliffhanger ending leading into Justice League 2. So, like, I don't know how evil Superman would be that much different from the Superman we've already seen in Man of Steel and Batman Superman.
Yeah.
But still, like, that's kind of an interesting idea. Like, I kind of respect that. But then once this, you know, they scrapped Justice League 2, they reworked their entire universe and whatever they're working on for this movie very last minute, and like they were working on this movie, you know, up until like I feel like a few weeks ago almost.
It must have been, yeah,
because a lot of the CGI just feels rushed. Like, it looks bad. The third act is just like this ugly mess of CGI, and there are like isolated moments of character banter that are like pretty fun, like, sure, you know, like you said, the scene where Superman is lifting a building full of civilians. And by the way, like, I was talking about how Henry Cavill gets to play like a version of Superman I would like to see. He gets to play, like, once Superman comes back and joins them in that final battle, he has this whole thing, like, he's talking to Batman, I guess I should say. And he's talking to Batman, and he's like, all right, explain to me what's going on. Batman's like, well, these mother boxes are doing this, and Superman stops him. He's like, wait, civilians. And he like hears like civilians cries in the distance and then goes off to save them, and like without even stopping to that's Superman. That's Superman. I wish I could have seen that in the first 2¾ movies that featured this character.
Yep. And, but instead we get Batman using a gun again.
So that's fun.
So there's that.
Yeah, but there are character banter moments that are fun. I think like the Flash and Cyborg get like a fun little conversation where they kind of like bond over like their own, like how they were both accidents of their own, like of their powers and stuff like that. Which is a scene where they're robbing Superman's grave, which is a little odd.
Yeah. I feel like that also like encapsulates a lot of this movie. We get a lot of, you know, I guess like you said before, it's the Whedon versus the Snyder flavor where we still are in the Snyderverse. We're still in dark, gritty. I mean, DC's trying their best to get away from that. And it's just like not good enough, I guess. But yeah. They're trying where we get, you know, silly like aside jokes while they're literally on top of his coffin trying to dig it out of the ground. And there's just, I feel like there's a lot of that juxtaposition in this movie that just doesn't flow together.
Yeah, exactly. But I will say there is one scene that I did like quite a bit, which is Batman's just save one person speech to the Flash.
Yes.
Which is this very great, very Joss Whedon-esque moment. Like the Flash is freaking out. Like that was, I will, you know, eat a hat if that was not Joss Whedon who wrote that.
Yeah.
Like, because it feels very Whedon-y. It's just, you know, the Flash is freaking out because he's never been in a fight before. And, you know, they're about to go into this like big thing with Steppenwolf. And Batman like looks at him like, hey, just save one person. And the Flash is able to do that. And then he like realizes he can do it and then saves everyone else. Like that was a nice moment. I liked that quite a bit.
Yeah. I think that fight when they're like in the tunnels beneath the harbor or whatever, that's my favorite part of the movie. I think it's the first, you know, the band is together fight where we get to see them interacting together and how all their powers play off each other, which is the most fun part of, you know, movies like The Avengers where, you know, we see, you know, the best one is Thor hits Cap's shield and like the shockwave blows off all the Nazis or whatever. Like that's cool. That stuff is cool. And we get to see that sort of stuff where, you know, particularly the scene where Wonder Woman dies for her sword and Flash is able to tap it back into her hand and right. Like all that kind of stuff. But like it's that one moment and then the big climactic battle at the end is just dumb. it's the trailer. We all saw the whole thing,
yeah,
basically.
Pretty much, yeah. And Steppenwolf is just never a credible villain. Like he just never feels he never feels like he's on the same set as any of the other characters. You know?
Weird that you said it that way.
Well, am I wrong?
No. That actor was not on set, probably.
Yeah.
I did just in the other moments that just jumped out to me. I did like the kind of return to Themyscira. I can never remember how to pronounce that. With Amazon.
The Amazons from Wonder Woman. Yeah, that was cool.
Yeah, that was cool, except it features the you know, the trope of like, hello, villain, like when Steppenwolf shows up and the Amazon says his name and then says what his plan is, probably, and then that thing happens. And, you know, that's cool. We get to see some more of that, like, weird acrobatic, you know, fighting style stuff of the Amazons that we got glimpses of in Wonder Woman, which was a lot of cool and interesting to see, even though there's that whole thing with the armor changes. I'm sure you saw that online.
Yes, yeah. So the armor is a little skimpier in this movie than it was in...
Yeah.
In Wonder Woman, which...
Wonder Woman.
Yeah, Zack Snyder movie, yeah, sure. But he directed Sucker Punch. Like, what do you expect, you know? But, yeah, you do go back to the Amazons, which is cool, and you see Connie Nielsen as well. J.K. Simmons appears in a couple scenes as Commissioner Gordon, which, you know, that's whatever. I feel like I don't remember any of his scenes, so there's that.
Yeah, he feels like... His character feels like Martin Freeman's character in... Civil War, where he's just kind of like there for some fun like stuff, but Martin Freeman's character is way more memorable and is way more important.
Civil War. he has like at least one big scene in Civil War where he's interrogating the Winter Soldier, right? He's talking to him, and he's also going to be in Black Panther, so it kind of like sets up his character there. I don't know if we'll ever see J.K. Simmons as Commissioner Gordon again. So you know,
I mean, we have the Batman if that's still happening,
right? But is Ben Affleck going to be in that?
Time will tell.
And if he's not, is J.K. Simmons going to be in that? You know, like
yeah,
who knows. I did want to throw out there that you see a Green Lantern at one point, which is wild.
Or a Green Lantern, yeah.
Yeah, it's not like Hal Jordan or anything, but it's like they show a flashback to like, you know, this ancient battle that everybody had with Steppenwolf or something, and like it's
the
like,
elves and the dwarves,
exactly,
and the ancient alliance with men. Yeah, it's the same.
It's all that. But like the Atlanteans and the Amazonians, and like you see a Green Lantern Corps like flying around, like ooh, Green Lantern, hey. Also, Ares is there. They say something like the gods are with us, and like
the elder gods, whatever. Yeah,
and one of them was Ares. I didn't even catch Ares being in the movie, but I guess they did like superimpose David Thewlis's face on somebody and. That was Ares.
Sure. we'll go with that.
Yeah. Let's talk about the post-credit scenes in this movie, Mike. There are two.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, the first one's like, you know, a little fun little scene. It's like Superman kind of – can Superman outrun the Flash type scene, which, you know, is a question that comic geeks have asked for, you know, millennia at this point or, you know, couple decades.
close enough.
Same difference. Which was fun. They'd already done kind of a similar thing on Supergirl with her in the Flash. So it's like, I have seen this already. But it's still nice to see. And like, I want to see more of that in these movies. Like,
yes.
That kind of like exploration of fun.
That's the tone I want these movies to have. Exactly. Is that.
And then there's the other scene, which was interesting. And I think sets up a potentially really cool direction for this franchise to go. But again, I'm really sick of DC being like, the next movie will be better than this one.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
just one more chance.
Just one more chance. But I did really like this post-credit scene. I don't know about you, but it was basically Joe Manganiello appears as Deathstroke, who is the character he was cast as. He's supposed to be in the Batman, and I don't think that's happening anymore. But now he's getting his own solo movie. Directed by Gareth Evans of The Raid, so that's pretty fucking cool. And he shows up on a boat, and who is there but Lex Luthor himself, Jesse Eisenberg. And he's talking to him, and he's like, yeah, I escaped from prison, and I've been watching from afar, and I'm seeing the Superman come back to life, and I'm thinking, like, why don't we start our own league or whatever? I'm paraphrasing, obviously.
Basically, we should have a league of our own. And then Tom Hanks shows up and tells him there's no crying in superhero movies.
And
it writes itself.
And then the next movie is just an all villains remake of a league of their own.
Holy shit!
And it's great.
It's just a softball match. It's about the softball playoffs between the heroes and the villains softball league.
It's the Legion of Doom versus the Suicide Squad.
And yes.
I love it. Anyway, yeah. So this is obviously hinting towards like the formation of the Legion of Doom, which is kind of like the antithesis of the Justice League. It's, you know, like Justice League, it's an assembly of all the big heroes. This is an assembly of all the big villains. And so you've got theoretically you've got Lex Luthor and Deathstroke heading up this. That much confirmed. And so I like that idea. I like that. That's not something Marvel has done. And they've done that in comics and stuff. They have like Sinister Six and all that in the Spider-Man comics, but they haven't done that in the movies. And that's something that DC could really get a jump on and do this really cool thing where you can introduce villains in all these movies. Cause for me, DC has always had the better villains than Marvel has, like just pound for pound. Like they have a lot of really cool villains to choose from. And so you could potentially do something really cool with this. Do I trust DC to do something really cool with this? Not so much. But
therein lies the rub. I can't wait to see Eisenberg's Lex Luthor play off against I can't even remember his name right now.
Jared Leto's Joker?
Yes, Jared Leto's Joker. Yes. Just those two in a scene together. Just because they're both as bonkers as you can get. Yeah. Like,
it's weird.
That'd be wild.
Because Jesse Eisenberg is basically doing the Joker as Lex Luthor.
Yeah.
And Jared Leto is doing Jesse Eisenberg's Lex Luthor as the Joker. And so, I am kind of intrigued by that. And I hate that I'm intrigued by that because I've been burned by this franchise so many times.
It's going to be interesting to see how a standalone Deathstroke movie or just Deathstroke in general is able to survive Deadpool. Because as far as I understand my comics history, Deadpool was a character created by Marvel as a spoof of Deathstroke or by that creator, like by that art writer or whatever.
Right.
Like, you know, the mercenary for hire whose name is also Wilson, with the two katanas on his back and is like the best assassin in the whole world and like all this stuff. So like to see how that character plays off, like Deathstroke in this kind of Snyderverse-y hypothetical, while Deadpool is like one of the most popular like superhero movie franchises right now.
That's
well,
true.
We'll see how Deadpool 2 does, I guess. But yeah, I don't know. That's just something I thought of after that scene, seeing Deathstroke. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see if Deadpool is able to just completely undercut Deathstroke.
Yeah, if audiences respond to it. And again, I don't know if the Deathstroke movie will even happen. I don't know if there's a lot of audience demand for that one. But I will say Deathstroke was a character on Arrow. He's on the season currently right now. He was the main villain in season 2 of that show. And he's the best villain the show ever had.
Oh, okay.
So he's a cool character when done pretty well. So and actually the CW TV shows did a Legion of Doom thing a while back. Legends of Tomorrow season 2 took a couple of villains from The Flash and Arrow and kind of put them together as a Legion of Doom. So it was Malcolm Merlyn, Damian Dark, and Reverse Flash, and they were all together as like this band of characters that would terrorize the heroes for an entire season, and it was great. It was awesome.
Yeah.
So if they can just take that, if they can just learn their lessons from the CW TV shows, the Justice League would be in a lot better place. As we're recording this, Crisis on Earth X is airing on TV right now, which is the big four-way crossover between Supergirl, Arrow, The Flash, and Legends of Tomorrow, where all the characters are hanging out for The Flash's wedding, and it gets crashed by alternate universe Nazi versions of themselves, and they have to stop the Nazi versions of themselves, and that's the movie I want to see.
Yeah, yeah, like, but like, that's the most comic book premise of anything ever.
Yeah,
and like, do that. That's the thing.
Just please do that.
Yeah, maybe like not so much on the whole Nazi thing right now, but like just do weird, silly shit. Like the direction Marvel has gone in with Guardians of the Galaxy and these, you know, Thor Ragnarok and these like big, silly cosmic romps. That's what we want. That's, I think, obviously, that's what audiences are responding to right now.
Yeah.
Like, maybe do it. Just do it.
That would be nice. Okay, Mike, do you have any final thoughts on Justice League, or should we wrap this up?
No, that's basically it. There's the one scene that is the most Whedon-y of the Whedon scenes, where after we have the big meeting with the bat signal for the first time, and we're all talking to Commissioner Gordon, and he turns around and everyone's gone but the Flash, and he's like, "Oh wow, they just leave like that." That I was like, "Oh, hello, Mr. Whedon, nice to meet you." I guess that's all. I just wanted to bring that one up.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, this is not a movie that warrants a lot of final discussions. So,
hopefully, Wonder Woman 2 is good. I guess
I think Wonder Woman 2 will. I mean, Patty Jenkins is coming back to direct it. Gal Gadot is starring. Like, and they like Wonder Woman was good. I liked Wonder Woman. I had problems with it like towards the third act. Like. And we talked about that, but and I think it still like has like just in terms of its visual style, like just the DC template does not look good. And the best,
I think so glossy.
I know, but the best part about Wonder Woman was the first like 20 minutes when they were just at the Amazon Island, like it was bright and like looked really cool. So I'm hoping Wonder Woman 2 is that. Like, if they just set an entire movie on Themyscira, I would be all in.
I'm down. I hope for the future of these DC movies, I would be down if they start just doing individual movies again, like if we get Deathstroke and we get Batman and we get you know, Wonder Woman 2 and all that stuff, and they just show up like they do in the you know, like Flash and Wonder Woman have an adventure together, done. I'm in. Like, that'd be so much fun.
I think that would be great. I think that is probably the direction they're going to take, like just do solo movies for a long time, because Justice League again did not do super well at the box office, and DC has to severely rethink their entire strategy, because they don't have, you know, a Kevin Feige to kind of keep the ship afloat. Right. You know, I think that is the big difference. Kevin Feige has made such a huge impact on what Marvel is today, and you know, other studios that have been floundering with this whole shared universe thing, like DC, like Universal with their Dark Monsters universe. You know, it just
I forgot about that.
You know, that one was a one and done, man. The Mummy is the Mummy came, the Mummy went, and they're shutting down pretty much everything else that. That is associated with that universe. At least with DC, like, they have like enough brand recognition with these characters, like, to basically just keep failing it until they get it right. But even so, man, it just feels like they don't have somebody like Kevin Feige to kind of keep this afloat. So I think their best bet is to just do some solo movies. You know, they got Wonder Woman 2. Aquaman's already, you know, it's already happening. So, and James Wan's doing that. That's awesome. Like, James Wan's a great director. So
if there's anyone that could save it, it's James Wan, hopefully.
Yeah. And that's the thing. I feel like watching the Aquaman stuff in this, I was like trying to be like, oh, is this like a hint of what's to come in James Wan's Aquaman? But I did not understand anything that was going on in the Atlantean scenes, because it was all underwater and it was garbled.
Amber Heard shows up. That was neat, I guess.
Yeah. You just totally glossed over my joke, but
no, I talked over it. I'm sorry.
I said I couldn't understand anything that went on in the underwater scenes, in the Atlantean scenes, because it was underwater and it was garbled.
God damn it. Oh man, you're welcome for making you say that a second time.
But anyway, yeah, Amber Heard does show up briefly. Supposedly Willem Dafoe had a cameo and then it was cut because he's in Aquaman. He didn't just randomly show up like, "Hey, I'm Willem Dafoe. You may remember me from such movies as Spider-Man and the Florida Project." So I think that about wraps up our discussion of Justice League. Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons and Dragons, my friends and I post our games at youtube.com/geonerd79.
And you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog and all of our podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. Thank you so much for listening to Filmbookcast, Mike Smith, Mike DiCriscio. If you're listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, subscribe, rate, take a moment to give us a review, 5 stars if you can. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you email about in the title of your email, because we produce just so many different ones, it's hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Now, join us for the next episode of Film Bookcast, where I guess we're playing it by ear, but if we can, I'd really like to review The Disaster Artist, Mike, if you're down.
Ooh.
That opens wide in 2 weeks, I think, so that would line up with our schedule. Mm-hmm. So that would be a cool one to review. So I'm looking forward to that, and then you can check out our next Complete Works, where we are talking Nicolas Cage's role in 2007's Next. So thanks so much for listening, guys. We are out.
Even without shark repellent,
he's tougher than he seems.
Other heroes often ask,
why is he always the top cat?
He drives us fast.